This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Omari Everett Phillips, the host of the channel. Today, we'll talk to Dr. Jonathan White about his new book, Shipwrecked, a true story of mutinies, jailbreaks, blockade running, and the slave trade. Dr. Jonathan White, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So, Dr. White, I wonder if you could just begin the interview just by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm a Civil War historian. I focus on the Civil War era broadly, but mostly on Lincoln and the history of slavery in the United States in the period before the war. I've written or edited 16 books for adult audiences. And then actually earlier about this year, I published my first children's book called My Day with Abe Lincoln. So I'm trying to dabble in all sorts of different things and get young people and old people interested in history.
Wonderful. And what was the process like sort of writing the children's book versus some of the more academic texts that you've written?
That one was a little bit of a journey, actually. So I've got two little girls, one just turned 8 and the other one is almost 11. And for a decade now, I've been telling them bedtime stories about all sorts of fantastical things. And I take them to lots of historic sites and read them a lot of history books. And so I decided I wanted to kind of take the storytelling that I do for them and turn it into a book. And I wanted to do something on Lincoln. Initially, my thought was to write just sort of a history of Lincoln's early life, his childhood, his time going to school. But I decided I didn't want to write, you know, just another dry kid's book about Lincoln. There's enough of those. And I had the idea to write what I'm calling a historical fantasy fiction about a third grade girl who doesn't want to go to school. She throws a tantrum on a Monday morning, which is something I've experienced way too many Monday mornings and every other weekday. And so she throws this tantrum. She doesn't want to go to school. And she decides to dress in the craziest outfit she can. And then she puts on a top hat from her brother's magic kit, and that transports her back to Indiana in the 1820s. And she winds up spending the whole day with Abraham Lincoln and his sister. Abe is an early teenager at that point in his life. She goes to school with him. She goes back to the cabin. And throughout her adventure, she learns all these incredible stories about Lincoln's childhood. And my hope was that this is a way of kind of giving kids their vegetables while they think they're getting ice cream. They're getting an adventure story, and it's really fun and exciting. But what I tell people is it's 100% historically accurate, except for the time travel part. But I spent 2 years researching it and sort of putting it together in this fun way. So that was sort of the process and how it evolved over time. And the publisher likes it, so I'm hoping to be able to do a second book in a series.
That sounds amazing. We'll have to find a channel to bring you on for that particular book as well.
Yeah, I would love to.
So let's talk a little bit more about Shipwrecked, right? So how did you come to this particular project?
So I wanted to write a history of the slave trade during the Civil War. I wanted to do both the international slave trade and the domestic slave trade. And I think I had the idea around 2014, and I started collecting all sorts of resources on both parts of that story. Let me back up for a second. So I had a student in the summer of 2015, and his name's Daniel Glenn. He's a phenomenal student, went on to law school and is now clerking for a federal court. And he was my research assistant, and I gave him a list of names of people who I knew had been involved in the slave trade. And I said, go on to newspapers.com and Chronicling America and other databases and just see what you can find. And so he took these names and he started searching. And one day he came into my office and he said, have you ever heard of Appleton Oaksmith? And I said, no, I mean, that's the strangest name I've ever heard in my life. If I'd heard it, I would never have forgotten it. And I asked him why. And he said, well, his name keeps coming up in these articles. So I told him, okay, add his name to the list and see what you can find. And as the project developed, I figured, okay, I'll have a chapter on Appleton Oaksmith. But then as I kept researching Appleton's story, I realized that his life touched so many of the most important moments of the Civil War era and into Reconstruction that he deserved a biography of his own, that it illuminated enough of the story of that period in American history that I wanted to tell it in its own. And so I jettisoned the idea of doing this broad history of the slave trade. I kept some pieces of it that worked their way into Shipwrecked. And then actually right around that same time, shortly after, maybe around 2018, I'm not sure, I met Robert Colby. He was doing research at UVA and I was there for something. And I saw his name on the register when you go in. And so, and I went up to him. I said, I recognize your name from Twitter. I'm John White. I wanted to meet you. And so I took him out to lunch and we talked, and I ended up finding out he was doing his dissertation at the time, which is about to be published as a book in about a week, on the slave trade in the Confederacy during the Civil War. So I said, give me your mailing address. And I sent him everything I had on the domestic slave trade. And then I just put all of my focus on Appleton and his story.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the sort of researching portion of this book, right? So what was it like sort of researching this book and these historical actors? These are such rich sort of characters, and we'll get into that a little bit more. What was that process like for you?
It was research for me is like detective work, and you find one piece of evidence and then you want to figure out where's the next piece, or you find half of a set of correspondence and you want to find the other side. And the thing about Appleton, there's a couple things about Appleton's story that really facilitated the research. On the one hand, he was involved in a number of federal trials, and that means that there are records at numerous branches of the National Archives, not just Washington, D.C. and Maryland, College Park, Maryland, but in Boston, New York, in San Francisco, in Atlanta. He has records everywhere. And so it was a lot of fun to be able to track those down and figure out those pieces of the story. The other aspect of it is that his name is a made-up name. So his mother was this very important first wave feminist. Her name, her birth name was Elizabeth Oakes Prince. And she married a man named Seba Smith, who was a famous journalist in the 1820s and 30s. And at first, I believe their marriage was happy, but over time, she came to really resent her husband. And for some reason, whether it was her first wave feminist principles or her dislike of her husband, or maybe she thought Smith was too boring of a last name, but for whatever reason, she had the New York State legislature take her married middle and last names and smush them together and created a last name Oaksmith. And I mean, that's relevant to the research because we live in a digital age and there are so many digitized newspapers that I was able to dig into. And the nice thing about researching someone with a made up last name was that if you searched for Oaksmith and you found something in a newspaper, it was some descendant of Elizabeth Oaksmith. It was one of her sons or one of their descendants. And so it made the research much easier than it would have been if he had just kept his father's last name of Smith.
Absolutely. So at the center of this work is this sort of continuance of the transatlantic slave trade after 1808. So how prevalent were slave traders bringing sort of captured Africans to the US after the 1808 ban?
There is a small number of slave trading ships that are brought into the United States after the ban, and they come in periodically throughout this period from 1808 up to 1820, when slavery is declared or slave trading is declared piracy, and then up until the 1860s when it's finally really cut off. The bulk of the slave trading ships went to Brazil during that period up until about 1850. And then between 1850 and into the 1860s, the bulk of the slave trading ships go to Cuba. But there are Americans who are involved in this slave trade. And one of the things that I think is surprising to a lot of people is these are often New Englanders. These are people from Portland, Maine, or from Massachusetts or Rhode Island. The ships are often built in New England. The financing is coming out of New York City and other parts of the North. And so, even though most of the ships during this period are not coming to the United States has a very central role in the slave trade, including the slave traders themselves.
So let's get into the fun parts here of the sort of content of the book. So who was Appleton Elk Smith?
So, Appleton was born in Portland, Maine, in the mid-1820s, and he was born into this literary family. His mother, again, was a prominent first wave feminist. She was a writer, she was a poet, a lecturer, an essayist, a playwright, a novelist. Some of her writings are actually still taught in college literature courses today. And in fact, there's an Elizabeth Oak Smith Society made up mostly of English professors who teach and research her work. So she was a really prominent person. And I'm convinced that if the story I tell in Shipwrecked hadn't happened, that we would still know who she was today, like we know Susan B. Anthony or Elizabeth Cady Stanton. I mean, she was that prominent. She married a man named Seba Smith, who was a journalist in Maine. And Seba Smith had a national reputation as well. And everyone in America who read the newspapers loved his writing. He created a fictional character named Jack Downing, who was this sort of backcountry Maine guy who would go to Washington, D.C. and give Andrew Jackson advice. And so, whether you were a Whig or a Democrat, you loved the Jack Downing stories. And Appleton was raised in this household with these prominent literary parents who tried to raise him to love literature and writing. And he was multilingual, he knew four or five languages. I mean, Appleton was a very well-educated guy, and much of that was the work of his mother. But he was always called to the sea. It ran in his blood, and he couldn't resist that urge. As early as 16 years old, he went on a merchant trip to China, and then in the 1840s, he goes on other voyages, which we'll talk about, I imagine, that get him into some trouble.
Absolutely. So what was the relationship between Appleton and his mother like?
It was a very close relationship, and as her marriage disintegrated in the late 1840s, her relationship with her boys got even closer. So Elizabeth was part of the literary that by the 1840s and 50s, they're living in New York City, and she's part of the literary culture there. And so she is invited to soirees with very prominent people. People like Edgar Allan Poe are big admirers of her work. And normally her husband would be the one who would escort her to these parties. But because the marriage was falling apart, she actually goes with Appleton and his brother Sidney. And so I think their relationship was very close by the late 1840s. And he has great admiration and love for his mother and escorts her to these very prominent places.
So let's talk about Appleton's world travels. What were these like, and how did this sort of lead him to getting entangled with the slave trade?
So in the late 1840s, he met a woman in New York and fell in love with her. And for some reason, it fell apart. We don't know exactly why. I think it was a woman named Anna Lynch or Ann Lynch, who was a very prominent hostess in New York City. She hosted some of these soirees, beautiful, vivacious, wealthy. And I think it was her because in his journal, Appleton wrote about falling in love with a woman named L and then it falling apart. And he burned some of his journals, which as a historian is like the last thing you want to hear or read. But he had to get out. And so he left New York. He got on a boat. He went around the coast of South America and wound up in San Francisco. And this is right during the gold rush. And he kept a journal as he went. And so he writes about the people he's meeting along the way, the women he's sleeping with, the things he's doing in different port cities in South America. And then he gets to San Francisco and he thinks this is where he's going to spend the rest of his life. But San Francisco was rife with crime. It was full of arson. The city was being burned down multiple times during the gold rush period. And Appleton just doesn't want to be there. And so around 1851, he purchases a boat called the Mary Adeline, and he takes her back around the coast of South America. And as he's going, his goal is to find a cargo that'll take him back home to New York, but he can't seem to locate one. And when he gets to Rio, he finds a Portuguese firm that says, well, we've got a cargo that needs to go to the Congo River on the west coast of Africa. And with nothing else to do, he accepts that. And so he lets some of the Portuguese merchants onto his ship, and he heads east across the Atlantic Ocean to make it to the Congo River. When he gets to the Congo River, it's kind of unclear what happens. He gets there, and there are some British warships there that are part of the British Africa Squadron. And the British Africa Squadron was there to try to stop slave trading from happening. But under the treaties at that time, they were not allowed to search American ships. And so when Appleton gets to the coast of Africa, he actually encounters two of these British warships and he allows them onto his ship. And that makes me think that he probably was not at least knowingly engaging in a slave trading voyage at this time. He didn't have to allow the British sailors on, but he did. They presumably looked around and did not see evidence of slave trading, and they let him go on his way. And I did go through some of the British archives and know that one of these ships had captured a slave trader about a week earlier. So these guys knew what to look for. They knew how to catch people, and they didn't detain Appleton. Well, Appleton gets onto the Congo River, and the current is so strong that his ship gets beached, and he's stuck on the shoreline, and 3,000 African warriors see him and attack. And he's a sitting duck at this point, I mean, completely unable to do anything to save himself. And at that point, those British ships that had searched him earlier come and rescue him. They fight against the African warriors. They go on board his ship. They get the cargo off so that the ship lightens, and then he's able to sail again. And this moment made international headlines. People called it the Battle of the Congo. And it's a really pivotal moment in his life, I think. Now, we don't know if he was slave trading. And my sense is if he was doing it kind of unwittingly. It was not uncommon in the first half of the 19th century for people involved in the slave trade to get unwitting sailors to the coast of Africa and then say, by the way, we're doing a slave trading voyage and you're either in or we're leaving you here and you're going to die. And so it's possible that the Portuguese on his ship were going to try to force him into a slave trading voyage. It's possible that he was doing it knowingly and we just don't know. It's a very complicated moment, but it's also an extraordinary moment that, again, was very well documented because of the international implications.
Absolutely. And can you talk about the role of the Lincoln administration in this narrative?
Yeah. So Lincoln gets elected president in 1860 and is inaugurated in 1861. So this is 9 years after the Battle of the Congo. And it's at that point that Appleton Oaksmith gets suspected of wanting to slave trade again, and he gets arrested. And he gets thrown in prison, and he's held in prison for a number of months before he's turned over. He's actually arrested through the State Department with military forces or in a military prison, and he's held under that jurisdiction until he's turned over to civil authorities. And the Lincoln administration very badly wants him and other slave traders to be convicted. My view of Lincoln is that when he's elected president, he is committed to stopping the spread of slavery into the Western territories. That was part of the Republican platform. He knows that he can't just end slavery where it exists. He believes the Constitution protects slavery in the Southern states, and so he doesn't believe he has the authority to do anything about that. Of course, that will change in 2 years when he says the Emancipation Proclamation is a war measure and that he can now do what he didn't believe he could do 2 years earlier. Now, that said, as early as May of 1861, Lincoln begins taking steps to try to strike at slavery in ways that he believes the Constitution allows him to do. And one of the things that the Constitution allows him to do is to strike at the transatlantic slave trade, because it had been illegal since 1808. It's just that most presidents up until 1861 didn't do anything to enforce the law. And so Lincoln tells his Interior Department and State Department, you're going to destroy the transatlantic slave trade. And they then spend the next 4 years doing just that. So Appleton gets arrested and gets prosecuted for outfitting ships for the slave trade. And at the same time, the Lincoln administration goes after another Portland, Maine guy named Nathaniel Gordon. Gordon had gone on at least three or four slave trading voyages in the 1850s. He got caught slave trading in August of 1860, and he had 897 Africans in the hull of his ship. And most of them were women and children. None appeared older than 40, and some appeared as young as 6 months old. So Nathaniel Gordon was caught red-handed and going after the weakest of the weak. And Gordon had actually been brought to New York City for trial in 1860 when James Buchanan was president, and his first trial led to a hung jury. And Gordon and his friends probably bribed the jury. When Lincoln gets into power, Lincoln has his new prosecutor go after Gordon again. And this time they sequester the jury so that no one can be bribed or influenced. And Gordon is convicted and sentenced to be executed. And thousands of people petition Lincoln for pardon, and Lincoln refuses. Lincoln grants Gordon, it's pure Lincolnian humor in my sense. Lincoln grants Gordon a 2-week stay of execution, Lincoln says, so that he can make the necessary preparations for the awful change which awaits him. In other words, Gordon needs to realize he's going to die, he's going to meet his maker, and he better get right with God before that happens. And as part of this 2-week stay of execution, Lincoln talks about how Africans are human beings who are children of the common God and Father of all men. And what Lincoln was saying in that moment was people like Nathaniel Gordon believed what the Dred Scott decision said, that Africans and African Americans were subhuman, and to quote Roger Taney, nothing but articles of merchandise to be bought and sold whenever a profit could be made. And Lincoln wanted Americans to realize, no, these are human beings who deserve dignity and respect and are not going to be traded in this way. And so Lincoln gave Gordon 2 weeks to think about it and then executed him. And it's the only time in American history that a slave trader received the full punishment for what he had done. And then the other piece of the story that Lincoln did is he negotiated a new treaty with Great Britain. So when Appleton was found on the coast of Africa in 1852, the British were not legally allowed to search his ship without him giving them permission to board. After 1862, with the Seward-Lyons Treaty, the British are now allowed to search American ships. And this will have an impact on slave traders and cause them to not want to sail under the American flag anymore. So Lincoln is doing a lot of different things in his administration to try to kill off the slave trade. And ultimately, he's part of a broader effort by the British and other world authorities, Atlantic world authorities, to destroy the slave trade. Most people believe by 1867, it's completely destroyed. Although I did see, apparently there's a new book or article that suggests that it extended a little bit later. I think I saw it on Twitter, and I haven't seen the actual scholarship yet, so I'm not sure what the evidence is. But at least until recently, most people thought it ended by the mid-1860s.
Okay, that's fascinating. And so what's Appleton's, what is his trial like when he's sort of caught or suspected of wanting to continue sort of slave trading?
So Appleton had gotten caught up with a fish oil factory owner in about 1860. He was flat broke. He needed a job. And so he starts working with this guy, and they allegedly decide that they need whale oil to put into the fish oil factory. And the thing is, in 1860 or 61, if you're going to get into the whaling industry, you're going to look really suspicious, because petroleum had been discovered in Titusville, Pennsylvania in 1859. And so the whaling industry was just tanking by the beginning of the Civil War. Well, he starts buying boats in New York City and in New Bedford, Massachusetts. And when he starts buying these boats, it looks really suspicious. And so some people in New York City turn him and say, yeah, you can buy our boat. So they sell him the boat, take the money, and then they go immediately to the U.S. Marshal and say, hey, we think this guy's a slave trader. So he gets arrested. They worry that they can't get a conviction in New York, so they transfer him up to Boston, where he goes to trial. And it's pretty interesting, because one of the things I try to show in this book is the great lengths that the Lincoln administration will go to destroy the slave trade. So they don't have enough evidence to arrest Appleton. So they actually arrest him under the suspension of habeas corpus. And then they transfer him over to civil authorities and they charge him in Boston. And they, at the same time that they're trying him in Boston, they're also prosecuting the ship he had gotten in New York. And they basically make it so that he can't be in two places at the same time. He can't have a lawyer at two places at the same time. And so he can't defend himself in two places at the same time. They make it very hard for him to defend himself. He has a lot of trouble finding a lawyer. He finally winds up with his uncle as his lawyer. And it's never a good idea to either have yourself or a relative as your attorney, as he's going to find out. And, you know, I will be fully candid. I don't know if he was actually involved in a slave trading voyage or not. To an extent, he was caught too early. He was caught before he actually did anything. So they prosecuted him based on what was on board his ship. Did it look like he was going to go on a whaling voyage, or did it look like he was going to go on a slaving voyage? And, you know, it may be that he was guilty and there was just not much to go on, because at any rate, his lawyer did not do a good job of defending him. And this was one of the funniest aspects of the book. The lawyer's best strategy for defending his client was to get about 13 women and girls and sit them around Appleton at the defense table and just hope that the jury might look over there and be like, oh, look at this nice guy. He's got all these lovely women sitting around him. He can't be that bad of a guy. And at one point during the testimony, his sister-in-law, Fanny, it faints. I think they had it staged, but she faints and Appleton gets up from the defense table and runs up and catches her before she hits the ground, and they call for smelling salts and they wake her up, and the jury is just like, wow. But that wasn't enough. They were not persuaded, and he was then convicted in June of 1862.
Absolutely. And what comes next for Appleton after he's convicted?
So Appleton is sent to prison, which was known as the Charles Street Jail and is now a luxury hotel in Boston called the Liberty Hotel. And for, I don't know, a mere $600 or $700 a night, you can stay in a luxury prison cell in Boston. It's actually a pretty cool prison. I've gone there twice now for when I was doing research, and I had dinner and lunch in a restaurant called Clink, which is where I believe Appleton's prison cell was. And some famous people stayed there. I shouldn't say stayed there. Were imprisoned there. Sacco and Vanzetti were there. Malcolm X was there. And the guy who, Frank Abagnale, I think is his name, the guy from the movie Catch Me If You Can, he was there for a while. So there were some very famous inmates there over the years. And so Appleton is there. And I won't tell the whole story for the sake of time, but suffice it to say, in September of 1862, he escapes. And he makes his way to Havana. And by this point, he is very bitter against the Union and the Lincoln administration. And so he had actually been pro-Union at the beginning of the Civil War. But by 1862 into 1863, he's very angry. He writes very angry poetry. And he ends up becoming a Confederate blockade runner. And he has a number of high-speed chases, or at least as high-speed as they can be in 1864, on the Gulf of Mexico, running cotton between Havana, Cuba, and Galveston, Texas. And so he's going to spend the rest of the war, and then all the way until 1872, actually, in exile outside of the United States.
Yeah. And so Appleton goes from a prisoner to a Confederate blockade runner, and then to an anti-Klan state legislator in North Carolina. Can you explain this political evolution that he has over this course of his life?
Yeah, this is something that's just extraordinary. So he stays in exile until 1872 when Ulysses S. Grant becomes convinced that he was innocent and gives him a pardon. And he comes back to the United States and just on a whim lands and settles in North Carolina. And so he's going to spend the rest of his life in North Carolina. And in 1874, he gets elected to the North Carolina State Legislature as an anti-Klan, pro-Black civil rights politician. And I should clarify, he does not support political rights for African Americans, but he does support civil rights in terms of certain rights that, in terms of public accommodations and other things like that. And I honestly don't know how to explain this transformation. And I'll tell you again, it all comes back to research and sources. A couple of years ago, one of his descendants contacted me, and she sent me a very angry email, basically threatened to sue me for defaming her family name, which I hadn't even finished the book yet, so she didn't know what I was going to say. And she said, "And I own a memoir that Appleton wrote, and I won't," and she wouldn't let me see it. And I pleaded with her over the course of months, "Can I please see this memoir? Because it might answer some questions that I want to know." Like, I don't know exactly how he escaped from jail. I have a chapter on it. I have a hunch, and I kind of explain different possibilities, but I don't know for sure. He might have told that in there. Or I don't know why he had this political transformation, and he might have explained it in a memoir. The best I could do is quote from speeches that he gave during the election and then once he was in the legislature. And he seems to have had a change of heart. And what's really incredible, actually, is after his time in the legislature, where he supports the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1875, he goes to New York City and participates in an event at the Cooper Union, which is still an art institute in Manhattan today. And he shares the stage with Henry Highland Garnett, one of the most important Black Presbyterian ministers and abolitionists of the Civil War era. For Appleton Oaksmith, a pro-slavery guy before the war who gets convicted of outfitting ships for the slave trade, to then share a stage with Henry Highland Garnett is incredible. And I wish I could explain it. I don't know if it was guilt. I don't know. Like, he just felt guilty inside. I don't know if he began interacting with African Americans in North Carolina and they changed his perspective. I don't know if he thought maybe he could just do it for political expediency and win as an independent candidate, dividing sort of the Republican and Democratic candidates. I don't know. But he did take these positions, which would not have been a necessarily easy thing for him to have done in North Carolina during Reconstruction. So it's an interesting moment in his life. And one of my favorite things about the book, actually, I love the illustrations I have in the book. And I've got a photograph of the North Carolina legislature. It was a biracial House of Representatives in 1874. And there is Appleton standing elbow to elbow with a Black legislator. And he never would have done that a decade earlier, but something had changed.
Oh, I hope you at some point in time are able to get your hands on that memoir. That would be amazing.
For the second edition.
Yes. So what sort of audience did you imagine for this work?
My hope is that it'll reach a broader audience. I think it could be a good book for college classes because it's a fast-paced story. It touches so many different moments from first wave feminism to the gold rush. We didn't even get into he's involved in Nicaraguan filibustering and Cuban liberation in the 1850s. He's involved in the secession movement trying to fight against secession and then all these issues during the Civil War and Reconstruction. So my hope is that professors could find it useful for students to read to help explore different aspects of American history broadly. And then I hope it'll be of interest to people who are interested in African American history, the Civil War, Lincoln, that people it's not an African American history book. In fact, African Americans, even though it's about the slave trade, play a pretty minor role in the book as a whole. But it does tell us a lot about the era in which slavery was the central issue of American history. And so I hope it'll reach a lot of readers, general readers and academics alike.
Yeah, there's a lot in this book that we cannot cover just in this interview. So what do you want readers to sort of take away from this book?
There's a lot that I hope they'll take away. The one is that the stories of ordinary or forgotten people can be very illuminating. And, you know, Elizabeth Oak Smith is worthy of a biography of her own, the mother. And there's actually an English professor named Timothy Sherman who teaches in Illinois, who has published two volumes out of a three-volume set of her writings. And then he's also working on a biography of her. So she, people like her should be restored and brought back to the historic, to our historic knowledge. The other thing I hope people will get out of this book is that the Lincoln administration went to great lengths to kill the transatlantic slave trade. So not only did they execute Gordon, not only did they negotiate this new treaty or go after Appleton Oak Smith very strongly, but they also were willing to violate international law in order to try to get him thrown in prison. And one of the craziest parts of the story is that by 1864, there's a Cuban slave trader hiding out in Manhattan, and Appleton is hiding out in Havana. And the problem is that there's no extradition treaty between Spain and the United States to negotiate a prisoner exchange. And so what does the Lincoln administration do? Well, they talk to the Spanish minister in DC and say, "Hey, you kidnap our guy and give him to us, and we'll kidnap your guy and give him to you, and we'll just do this international illegal prisoner swap." And no one had ever figured out the backstory to this moment. A couple of scholars had written about the Cuban slave trader in New York and his extradition to Cuba, but no one had figured out that it was actually a trade going on, and it shows just how much the Lincoln administration wanted to kill the transatlantic slave trade. They arguably violate US law by suspending habeas corpus and using that to arrest Appleton. And I think they arguably violate international law by doing this prisoner swap. And so I think the story really illuminates what Lincoln was doing.
Well, Dr. White, we've taken up a lot of your time, and thank you for being so generous with that. I'll ask the dreaded one final question here. What are you working on now?
So I'm doing a couple of projects. I'm working with my friend Timothy Orr on a photographic history of New York City during the Civil War, and that should be out later this year. And then I'm editing the diaries of a Minnesota soldier who fought in the Dakota War in 1862 and then became an officer in the 68th U.S. Colored Troops in the southwestern, not really the southwest, but I guess like the southwestern part of the main part of the Civil War. So like Missouri and Mississippi and Tennessee and that region. And then my big project right now is I'm writing a history of two enslaved men who escaped from bondage, and one of the guys had two daughters who were still stuck in slavery, and in the process of rescuing them from slavery, they kill their former enslaver. And it's this incredible story that explores their lives and experiences, but then also brings Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation into it. And so that book I'm only about 20,000 words into, but I'm hoping to finish that one by 2025. So those are the three things. And then the children's book. I've already written book two, so I've got a lot of balls that I'm juggling in the air, but those are the things I'm working on.
Definitely sounds like, and they all sound amazing and wonderful. I'll look out for all of those as they start to trickle out. Dr. Jonathan White, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed the conversation. I really enjoyed the book. It is a wonderful book that I think, as you said, sort of illuminates so much about sort of the era that we're speaking about. So thank you for the book. Thank you for the conversation, and I'll talk to you next time. Take care.
Thanks so much.